I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. It's not uncommon for Americans to sit down to a plate of lasagna or to stir-fry meat and vegetables. The rich immigrant history of our country has influenced many of the foods we eat. Joining us to discuss the intersection of food, family, and cultures is John Carafoli. He's a food stylist and writer and the author of several cookbooks. His latest book is Great Italian-American Food in New England, History, Traditions, and Memories. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you.
And on the phone is Ann Mendelson. She's a culinary historian and author whose latest book is Chow Chop Suey, Food and the Chinese American Journey. Good morning, Anne.
Hi.
So, John, you grew up in post-war Sagamore Beach, and for years that region was Italian-American enclave there. So do you know what it was about that area that drew so many Italian immigrants?
Yes. It wasn't Sagamore Beach. I ended up in Sagamore Beach, but it was the Sagamore Village under the bridge. They came in the early... in the late 1800s to dig the canal with wheelbarrows and shovels. And then they weren't treated very well. They went into the town of Sandwich because they weren't being fed and they didn't have money. They weren't being paid. So they went and rallied in the town and they thought they were going to kill kill people there. In the end, they were paid and they got back... got the food, and then they left the town of Sagamore. And later, they came back to work at the Keith Car Works, and that's how the village started in Sagamore and Sandwich.
Yeah. Rosina was an Italian neighbor who became a second mother to you. What are some of your fondest food memories of Rosina?
Well, one day I saw her. I was 12 years old. I saw her walking across the lawn with her apron full of mushrooms, and I decided, oh, so I went over and I saw her, oh, you get them in the woods. So I went the next day, I go to the woods. I come back with all these mushrooms, and she said, she picks out the ones that were good, the ones that were bad. Now you go back and you put them in a pan with a silver dollar, a piece of parsley, and...
silver dollar?
Yeah, silver dollar, right. So, and I told her, I went back and I did all these things very fast because I'm very spontaneous that way. Came back and I said, oh, bread, piece of bread. If I come back, so I went back and I said, Rosina, I understand about the silver dollar, the parsley, but what about the bread? Oh, you give the bread to the chickens. If the chickens die, then you don't eat the mushrooms.
Oh, that's, what does a silver dollar do? I never heard
it tarnishes. It probably tarnishes. It's all a folklore. Yeah, it's not probably real.
Yeah, you got to be careful with those mushrooms, right? And you've written many books that look at culinary traditions around the world. What's your own culinary history?
Oh, I'm mixed up everything. on the one side, my mother's family from the Midwest. They were Irish Catholics on one side and WASPs with Mayflower roots on the other side. My father's family, part from Lithuania and part from Ukraine, Jewish immigrants around the turn of the 19th, 20th century.
Wow. We have similar backgrounds. And on the flip side, my father's mother, my grandmother was from Lithuania. Her parents were Lithuanian. So I remember all of the foods that she would cook. And then on my mother's side, it was very much the Irish and English and a little bit more kind of bland food that my other grandmother would cook. So, and one of your first books was Stand Facing the Stove. And it's the story of the women who wrote The Joy of Cooking. What compelled you to write the book? And what do you think we might be surprised to learn about this mother and daughter who wrote that book?
Well, I think my motivation was that I loved the book since I learned to cook. It just opened up so much for me. And I think there are probably millions and millions of people who would say exactly the same thing, that without the joy of cooking, they never would have learned to cook, or it would have been a lot harder. The women who wrote it originally, Irma Rombauer and Marion Rombauer Becker, they were very, very conscious of their immigrant ethnic roots. They were German to the core, St. Louis Germans. And in, well, when Irma, she was born in 1877, when she was growing up, everybody spoke German. And I don't think she learned English until she was 5 or 6. When her daughter, Marion, was growing up, the family still spoke a lot of German at home. And the food was German, very, very German. They were conscious of not being exactly like other Americans. But that was changing. Things went through, well, there were a lot of ups and downs in assimilation. World War One came along, and all of a sudden the Germans were public enemy number one. After the war, they survived a lot of hostility, and they became real Americans. They felt themselves to be part of
love story about.
But I don't think we should take for granted that that process was always easy for people.
Yeah. I had a copy of The Joy of Cooking as well. I don't know that that's what really inspired me to start. I wasn't a very good cook until I was an adult for sure. But Jen, what, you were 12 when you started cooking?
I did. It was after my mother died and I needed something to hang on to. So I got involved in cooking for my aunt and my brother and small things, but they were things that I learned from the women in the neighborhood.
Yeah, your Italian neighbors, mostly.
My Italian,
yeah.
There was all yeah. Italian.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
had their grape arbors in the backyard, the men, and then they would kill the pig in the fall, like just like what they did in Italy.
Yeah. What about you, Anne? When did you start cooking?
I don't think I really got into it until I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. My mother belonged to the generation when... forward-looking progressive people with liberal political opinions, they didn't pay that much attention to cooking, or they thought maybe women shouldn't be relegated to the kitchen. So I didn't learn to take pleasure in cooking till I had left home and was eating food cooked by friends who had had more, let's say, earlier education in the real pleasures of cooking.
Yeah.
I think that I was always fascinated by the idea of different cuisines, the different peoples who came to America. To me, it was exciting to think that people from Italy didn't cook the sort of plain Midwestern-rooted food that my mother cooked. It was exciting to think of the German Christmas cookies that my mother's godmother sent us from Wisconsin every year. And it was exciting to think, gee, there's people who actually make stuff like gefilte fish. My mother, who was not Jewish, did not make gefilte fish or anything like it. And I had no connection with Jewish cuisine until I was grown up.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think I had any influence with ethnic foods until I was an adult as well. You know, just, you know, your normal everyday American foods. And so you grew up in this Italian neighborhood, John, and mostly ate Italian food then. So when did you kind of experience, you know, other ethnic foods?
Well, I didn't eat any fish until I was about 18.
Wow.
And then I think it was when I went to Chicago when I was 20. I packed a bag and left and decided to pursue my career as a designer, art director. And I was in Chicago, I was exposed to a lot of different foods, you know, and it was very exciting to me. And I worked as a food editor of a magazine, and I worked with a food style, so we were getting a lot of different foods that we could experience that I hadn't had before.
Yeah, one of the things that we find is the sort of a Americanization, if you will, of foods. And I want to talk about the cover of your book, John, because on the cover of your book, you'll see something. Everybody who loves Italian food here, a nice big plate of spaghetti and meatballs. But when you're in Italy, you don't get your meatballs with spaghetti, right?
No, you don't. You know, you only get they. You would only get meatballs and spaghetti if you were in a restaurant that catered to Americans. They do a different kind of a meatball. They call them polpetti, and sometimes they're served in broth with pasta or whatever, a simple pasta like pastini or something. But you will not usually find it in Italy unless it was a restaurant that catered to Americans.
So what would you find? Just spaghetti and sauce?
You'd find spaghetti done in different ways. You know, they'll serve it with truffles, you know. Or let me see, how else would they do it? There's a variety of different ways that they would do it. Just simple red sauce.
So how did we come up with our spaghetti and meatballs? We just, somewhere along the line, somebody liked the combination?
That's American.
Yeah.
And I purposely put that on the cover because, in working with my editor, because it is American.
Yeah, yeah. And that's so true of many foods, right? That, you know, what we consider, like in your book, what we consider Chinese food is really Americanized Chinese food.
Oh, very much. Yes, and the Chinese, it's sort of hard to separate Chinese food in America from politics, from the very, very hard time that the Chinese were given by white people in America. It was probably the most brutal story of racial oppression in this country, aside from what was done to African Americans and Native Americans. After that, the Chinese came third and were very badly treated. It was at a time when Chinese were being lynched, they were being persecuted. They were considered the most undesirable of undesirable aliens. And they had one thing on their side. They could cook. And they understood the tastes of white Americans. They had a great insight into the preferences of these people who were treating them so badly. They invented a kind of a cuisine that was based on Cantonese cuisine, but at the same time it pushed all the right buttons for white Americans. There was a lot of sugar, there were brown gravies, there were sweet and sour effects, things that weren't absolutely alien to all Chinese food, but they were not used in the same way. So this hybrid cuisine, this sort of chop suey cuisine, was invented by the Chinese to please white Americans in about the 1890s and the years leading up to World War I.
And we should say your latest book looks at Chinese immigration and the discrimination that they suffered, and of course how Chinese food became this mainstay of American cuisine. You know, it's interesting. It was in the late 70s. I was in Paris, and I was there for a while, and there was a Chinese restaurant that I really enjoyed eating at, and it was nothing like the Chinese restaurants that we have here in the United States.
Hmm.
It was completely different. I loved it.
The people who ran it might have come from a different part of China.
It could be, yeah, yeah.
All the regional cuisines of China are extremely varied. Or just maybe they never had the need to invent anything like the chop suey cuisine
right.
in France.
Now, going back to the women who wrote The Joy of Cooking, what are some of the German influences on American food that we might not recognize today?
Well, hamburgers, Frankfurters got renamed Liberty Sausage. Hamburgers got renamed Liberty Sandwiches. Sauerkraut got renamed Liberty Cabbage in World War I when the Germans were persona non grata, very much like the freedom fries instead of the French fries during the Second Iraq War. There's a big influence on cakes and pastries. Some of the American taste for sweet and sour is probably linked to German preferences. There were a lot of the sausage, a lot of the cured meat repertoire was very much influenced by the Germans. Mm.
We are talking about food, traditions, and memories, and we're going to talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the intersection of food, family, and culture. Do you have a favorite recipe or food tradition? How are you passing down your food traditions? 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio is John Carafoli, food stylist and writer. He's the author of his latest book, is Great Italian-American Food in New England, History, Traditions, and Memories. On the phone, Ann Mendelson, culinary historian. She's the author of Chow Chop Suey, Food and the Chinese American Journey. And also joining us on the phone now is Allie Burlow, one of the hosts of WCAI's Local Food Report. She's also the author of The Food Activist Handbook, Big and Small Things You Can Do to Help Provide Fresh, Healthy Food for Your Community. Good morning, Allie.
Good morning, Mindy. Hello, everybody.
Allie, you have some fond memories of the joy of cooking. Wasn't it your dad that used to do a lot of cooking?
Yes. Every Friday night, my father would come home, and it was his meditation to make bread. He started off with that recipe, and then he would, you know, fiddle around with it a little bit, but that joy of cooking is, I think the spine is broken up to the bread recipe. Yeah, definitely.
Tell us a little about you. You also have some German roots. Tell us a little about the German and the Jewish influences that make their way into your kitchen.
Yeah. My mother's from Germany, and I spoke with her this morning just before the show about the first cookbook that she received when she moved here in the 50s, and it was the Betty Crocker cookbook. And then her husband, my father, picked up the joy of cooking. But it was really, first it was Betty Crocker and then joy of cooking. And from the joy of cooking, she really learned how to, she said she made a lot of casseroles out of that. But my mother also was a scientist. So a lot of my cooking comes from just experimenting with processes, really, not just flavors. And then my husband is Jewish, and so when we had kids, that's when I became much more interested in Jewish cooking. And the cookbook for me that kind of brought it all together and made sense was called The Book of Jewish Food by Claudia Roden. And it's about the entire, you know, all over the world, these Jewish recipes. And that was a really interesting voyage, in a sense, for me to take to connect to the Jewish culinary history.
As you said that, I heard Anne sigh, and John went, "Oh, my favorite."
I've met Claudia. She's wonderful, and we email back and forth every once in a while. She's a wonderful, and her recipes work.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anne, you're a fan too.
Oh yes, I've met Claudia, and that book. Well, her first book that became famous was, I think the title was A Book of Middle Eastern Food. Her family were Egyptian Jews and lived in different parts of the Mideast until they were driven out by wars. This would have been like the 1950s. So this Book of Middle Eastern Food covered all kinds of regions of the Middle East. But then the Book of Jewish Food, it was completely unlike most earlier Jewish cookbooks. It was like a bookend or a counterpart to the Book of Middle Eastern Food. There was a section devoted to the food of the Ashkenazim, the people from northeastern Europe, who are kind of synonymous with Jewish food in America. But then there was a larger section devoted to the food of the Sephardi Jews in Southern Europe and the Middle East. And so you saw these dishes as a completely different aspect of Jewish cooking that had not been explored before in any American cookbook. Mm. And something about the way she put these things together, the way she contrasted the different Jewish traditions, it was just eye-opening. Mm. It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the cooking of Northern Europe, and you made me just a flash in my mind. Our daughter is adopted from Latvia, and when we visited there, I fell in love with the food there. I don't think I ate a single thing that I didn't like. But what was interesting is it was very hard. My husband and I, we had a guide, but we went out one night on our own, which she told us not to do, but we did it anyway. And we went to a restaurant, and normally you can look at a menu, and even if you don't speak the language, you can figure out what's fish, what's chicken, we couldn't figure out, and we just pointed any old thing on there. We just pointed, and we ate it, loved it, but still have no idea what we ate. But the food, I don't know if any of you have ever visited Latvia, but the food there is fabulous, just fabulous. Ali, I want you to talk a little bit about, you know, in this little southeast corner of the state here, we're influenced by Portuguese immigrants, and there's a lot of food here that we've sort of Americanized from our Portuguese friends.
Yeah, there are. I mean, I always think about kale soups and things like that, but also what's happening, I think, the second wave of a large group of immigrants are Brazilians, and they're really influencing not just the foods that they cook, but also what farmers are growing. I've noticed and worked with farmers raising crops that come from Brazil that can grow on Martha's Vineyard. And those are now, I mean, it's fabulous for the farmers because they're opening up a whole new market. So something like taioba, which is a really velvety cooking green, machixe, which is kind of a cucumbery thing, and gilo. These are all really popular, particularly taioba and gilo in the Brazilian groups. And it's wonderful to think that, you know, people that travel from Brazil come to America and actually can grow crops that they're familiar with.
Yeah.
I always think of, you know, what if we were an immigrant and couldn't get our tomatoes, you know, our summer tomatoes or corn or something like that, and then found out we could. You know, it's just a really, it's a great connection, I think.
Yeah. I also think there's a lot of people now who are really experimenting with things they've never heard of before, spices or like some of these greens you're talking about, Allie. I'm always been so impressed about how willing you are to experiment. I didn't realize your mom was a scientist, so now it all makes sense to me. But you really are not afraid to try different things and really come up with some really interesting combinations.
Well, I've been having those last couple of years, so much fun making ice cream, of all things. But it really is a wonderful vehicle to try different flavors because of the fat in the cream. And so that's been, again, it's kind of a big science project.
Yeah.
But you can make spicy, sweet ice creams, you know, things like that. So it's fun.
Yeah. John, you want to say something?
Yeah. I'm going to be writing an article on four ethnics on the Cape: Jamaican, Asian, Greek, and Brazil. The people that I'm doing it for don't know it yet, but I'm going to be. But I have a gardener that comes to my house. He's from Jamaica. And he introduced me to Callaloo, which is fabulous.
He
grows it, and it's a, like a spinach.
Oh.
And it's cooked. All you do is just wash it, throw it in the pan with garlic and olive oil, and toss it and have it as a green. He also grows it and sells it to the Jamaican market down in Hyannis. So I'm kind of excited about this little project that I'm going to get into.
Exactly, yeah. What fun. advice for people, you know, we hear about all these things that, like, this Callaloo that I've never heard of before, and people probably go, what do I do with it? So, Ali, being the science experiment person here, what do you suggest for people who want to try things but they aren't really sure what to do?
Well, I mean, I think going back to, as John said, trusted cookbooks really help because they, you know, if the recipes work, you'll have success, and then you can, you know, improvise from there. And one of the cookbooks that I really like a lot about our region is called In Cod We Trust. It's the cuisine of central and coastal Massachusetts by Heather Atwood, and she goes through the towns and, you know, pulls out the Portuguese influences and the Brazilian influences, and as well as the age old classics, and writes about them. Mm. But I think, you know, starting off with a good recipe, also Google, I have to say, you can find out a lot about a different ingredient, a new ingredient. As John said, you know, meeting the people that know that ingredient, you know, like Kalalu or Taioba, like how do they cook it and cooking with them. Yeah. I mean, there's really nothing like that to bring people together, I think.
I'd like to put in a plug for a cookbook by a friend of mine. And John's Maricel Precilla, Precilla, and the book is La Gran Cocina Latina. And it's about the foods of Latin America, all Latin America. So these things that come from the Caribbean, you know, these plants that are cooked like spinach, all different roots and leaves and grain crops that are now coming into this country with the immigration. She talks about them and she gives wonderful recipes.
Mm. And what about the her short ribs with the chocolate that we have in her restaurant?
Chocolate?
Yeah. I told her keep doing it, I think of her, and I told her the last time I saw her, I said, I don't have to come to your restaurant for your short ribs with the chocolate. It's fabulous.
Mm. We'd love
She's
to hear.
She's an expert on chocolate.
Yeah, she is.
She cooks with chocolate in very inventive ways, like people in Mexico or parts of Peru.
Love to hear from listeners about their food traditions and how they're handing them down or changing, mixing it up a little bit. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Sometimes there's things in your own backyard that you don't even realize are delicious. We talked about this a while ago, that pokeweed that grows, you know, that has the purpley berries. When it first comes up before it has the berries, do you know you can eat that? And it's delicious. It tastes like a cross between asparagus and spinach, which I never would have thought to do. But we had a caller who called in and told us about this. And I thought, huh, interesting. But he brought some in after the show and we tried it. And it was really good. But you do have to be really careful with the pokeweed because you cannot eat the roots. I think they're somewhat poisonous. So you want to be careful. So that's enough to scare you. But the leaves, you know, before those berries come out. Really, really delicious. And who knew, right? See, I just told you something you didn't know.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
The American Indians in this part of the country, they used to gather pokeweed when it was young in the spring and cook it.
That's right. Yeah, that's when you do it. You don't. Once it gets too big, it's not good. You got to do it when it's smaller.
This is the time for in another month or two, is for dandelions in the yard. You know, just cut them. They're great in salads.
Aren't they bitter?
No. The small ones, no.
You actually eat the flower itself or the leaf?
No, it's before they flower.
Before they flower, okay.
Yeah, just make sure that nobody sprayed them.
I don't. Nobody sprays my yard, and it's an acre of land, and I go out and get them and come home, wash them, and toss them with a boiled egg, oil and vinegar, and that's it.
Wow. I've heard of dandelion wine. Have you ever tried that?
No.
No, I haven't either. It doesn't really sound that appetizing to me either. John, I want to ask you about your cookbook is part travelogue and part history and recipes. So how did you do the research for this?
Oh, well, it was very interesting because the first place I started out was in Vermont. In Barry, Vermont. I usually called the historical societies and libraries, and I called the historical society in Barry, Vermont, and I said, are there any older generation of Italians still in Barry? Yes, we have one working right here in the office. I said, oh, may I speak with her? Hi, my name is Nelda Rossi. I said, I'm doing a book. I explained what I was doing. Well, I can't talk now. And she went on, but call me this afternoon at 3 o'clock. Well, we're friends, and she is such a sweetheart. She's in the book, and that's how the process started up there. And then I was there to give a talk with my PowerPoint presentation, a talk, and they're delightful people. And the cemetery is a wild place, but that's Barry. But that's how I started the research on the book. And the Sandwich Public Library, every time I wanted something, they gave it to me, and the Historical Society here. And I just donated all the research material to the archives at the Bourne Historical Society.
Yeah, well, that's been fun. Allie, any parting thoughts before we let you run?
I just encourage people to look around their neighborhood and however it is that they're interested in food, and follow their passion with that, you know, whether it's, as John did, with history, maybe it's cultural. Maybe you're just looking for, you know, how do I eat out of my backyard, you know, foraging. So I really encourage people to start cooking and get to know our neighbors.
Yeah. Allie Burlow is one of the co-hosts of WCAI's Local Food Report. She's also the author of the Food Activist Handbook, Big and Small Things You Can Do to Help Provide Fresh, Healthy Food for Your Community. Thanks, Allie, for being with us this morning.
Thank you all.
And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about food, family, and culture with John Carafoli, food stylist and writer. He's the author of several cookbooks. His latest is Great Italian-American Food in New England, History, Traditions, and More. On the phone is Ann Mendelson, culinary historian. She's the author of Chow Chop Suey, Food and the Chinese-American Journey. We'd love to hear from you. What are your food traditions? How are you connecting with family and heritage through food? 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. One of the things, we have recipes that are passed down, especially by word of mouth, and they aren't always precise measurements. And John, in your book, you have this, is it Brasadella recipe? Did I say that right? Recipe?
Brasadella.
Okay, that you got from your dear friend. And you write, she created the bread through instinct and intuition. So this is emblematic of how we've shared food traditions, but it might make writing a cookbook a little bit difficult. So what do you do?
Well, I went over to her house. It was Mafalda Muffy Maiolini. We called her Muffy. And she was a great cook. She's one of the best cooks in the town. Well, there were a lot of them. But she lived until she was 90 alone in her home and cooked for herself. I went over there one day, and I said, I want you to make the bruschetta. So she goes, she puts everything, all the things out on the counter. She starts making it. I said, wait a minute. How much sugar did you put? Oh, I don't know. I said, okay, stop. We're going to have to measure it. That's how I did it.
Oh boy. Yeah. And that, you must've come across that too, when you're trying to, recreate somebody's recipe who just does it.
Well, I want to chime in with a story from Mamie Sheraton, who wrote a terrific cookbook called From My Mother's Kitchen, which is about the Jewish, sort of German and Austrian and Eastern European Jewish cooking that she grew up with. So her mother was getting on in years, and she decided it was time to really grab this heritage while it was still there. And she said, can I come and get your recipes? First day, she shows up in the kitchen with her notebook and starts saying how much this, how much that. And her mother looked at her and said, are we going to measure or are we going to cook?
That's great.
Well, you know, I mentioned I didn't really learn to cook well. I could bake. You know, as a teenager, I was a baker. But, you know, the other stuff I wasn't so great at. My husband's a great cook. And my best friend is also, she owns restaurants, so she's great. And she just throws things in, same thing. And I was, okay, she gives me her recipe for crab cakes. I'm like, well, how much of this? She goes, I don't know, I just look at it. And so I've... Through them, I have actually gotten to the point where I can go, I can smell the spice and say, well, yeah, maybe that'll work. But it's very intimidating in the beginning to just kind of go with your gut.
Yeah, and Chinese stir frying is very, very difficult to turn into recipes because it all has to happen so fast.
Right.
It's like everything is over in 5 minutes. So if you don't have the knowledge in mind, As you start throwing together the ingredients in this super hot wok, you're lost.
Yeah.
You just need to you need to foresee a certain amount of failure and roll with the punches, and keep at it until you've learned past your mistakes.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the best ways, and you know this, is to have your all the ingredients set out and be very planned before you do any of this cooking.
Yeah, because then you go, oh, I thought I had cilantro.
Right, I've done that.
We've all done that. The American palate has expanded significantly, and perhaps because of the influence of immigrant cooking and cuisine. And how does what we eat today differ from what Americans were typically eating when the first editions of The Joy of Cooking were published back in the 1930s and 40s?
Well, there was a big kind of WASPy, New England-y and Midwestern, very white bread that was good food when well cooked, but it didn't have a very broad range of flavors, and there were ingredients that were just at that time unknown. So I think we owe everything to immigrants who started coming after the immigration laws were changed in 1965 under President Johnson. Since then, this is now more than 50 years ago, and it's been a revolution in the American palate. People who were cooking from The Joy of Cooking in the 1950s, they didn't know anything about real Chinese ingredients. They barely knew about soy sauce. They had a very limited idea of, let's say, Russian or Eastern European cooking. Immigrants were not coming in from Brazil or the Caribbean or West Africa. And it's been a challenge for cookbook authors who themselves were not raised in anything but WASP or German, Northern European traditions, to keep up with what's happening. It's unbelievable. Mm. Who would have thought of Americans eating raw fish
right.
50 years ago?
Yeah, you wouldn't. You know, we're talking a lot about Chinese food and Italian, and we haven't mentioned the influence of Mexico on food, especially in the Southwest, where there's a long history,
mm-hmm.
You know, due to the fact that the Southwest was part of Mexico until 1848. So, and it's interesting, too, when you look at Mexican restaurants, along in some of the Southwest states versus what we find here in New England, they're very different.
Well, Mexico was a special case for a long time because the agriculture industry needed laborers from like the 1930s and 40s on. And Mexicans were admitted under special provisions to take jobs that other people turned their noses up at. At first, they came mostly from the border country. But in the last 20, 30 years, Mexicans have started immigrating from many, many parts of Mexico, which is a humongous country. It's a very, very large country. And the regional cuisines of Mexico are totally different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
People in the far south, they don't cook with the same range of ingredients as people who are close to the border of Arizona, New mm-hmm. Mexico. And so Mexican cuisine is more diverse in this country than it ever has been. There are Mexicans working now in Oregon, Washington State, many parts of the Midwest, many parts of New England. And nobody could have foreseen how diverse Mexican cuisine would turn out to be in America, in America, north of the border.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's kind of like some of the Americanization we've done of the Italian food. We've done the same thing with some of the Mexican dishes and the Chinese food as well.
Well, you know, you go to Italy and each region has their specialty. You know, it's fascinating. I mean, I was in Calabria. They have a pasta that's called filet, and it's done on a skewer. I mean, it's a different pasta that's done in the north. You know, in the north, it's bologna with the tortellinis. But it's fascinating to go from one region to the other to see how they cook and the ingredients that they use.
Yeah. The go ahead, Anne.
One thing you have to remember that Italy is a country with a lot of mountains, a lot of geographical barriers, South Mexico. And in this country, almost from the time it was settled, there were pretty good roads. As people moved west, the roads moved west. The railroads came in the 1860s. So our country gave people access to foods, the same foods, throughout a big geographical range from the East Coast to the West Coast. We didn't have the tremendous barriers, except for the Rocky Mountains. People were able to spread traditions, to spread new ingredients as they became fashionable from one coast to the other with very little to hinder them, where the whole history of Mexico, the history of Italy, was so much determined by geographical barriers from ancient times.
Mm. The sights and smells of food can bring back a flood of memories. John, as you talked with Italian Americans in New England who make their livelihoods through food, how much did their memories of food influence what they're doing today? We all have childhood food memories.
How much did they?
Yeah, I mean, did that? Was it like you talked about started cooking when you were 12 and you were very much influenced by your Italian neighbors? And I mean, these cooks that you talked about, were they influenced by something that the foods that they experienced in childhood?
Oh, yeah. You know, there's a story in the book about I went to in Barry. It's Vino di Campo. It's a retired gentleman. He's in his 90s and his daughter-in-law. Their upbringing, it's very interesting because how this crossovers, because I found a recipe that they did for an antipasto, preserved antipasto, that is very similar to the one my surrogate mother did of all these different kinds of vegetables, and she puts an anchovy on the top and then preserves it. They all had their memories, and some of them weren't very clear. It's sort of very vague because things change through through history and the word of mouth, because it just does, and it changes the element.
And I think comfort food is something we all kind of, I mean, as a kid, we all have those comfort foods.
We do.
You get to your point of, I need some comfort food.
You know, food is very powerful. I mean, it can heal, it can comfort, it can it celebrate, it can bring relationships together. Has a myriad of...
Unless they're collected, recipes and cooking techniques from first and second generation immigrants could be lost. And I know that's one of the reasons that you wanted to write this book. In your estimation, how long does it take before the cooking and eating habits of immigrants assimilate into a point that the recipes could be lost?
Well, I think the younger generation, a lot of them don't care. Because when I was looking for photographs, for instance, or recipes that their mother had, where are they? Well, I think they got lost in the move, or they're up in the attic somewhere, or something like that. But this happened with photos. I had a lot of problems with the photos, but I did get a lot of them for the book. But the recipes, a lot of them are handed down, as we know, but...
And sometimes I mentioned this before we went on the air, I'll never be able to eat a piece of panucci and not think of my grandmother. She made the best panucci in the world. And I'm so sorry I never wrote down the recipe when she was alive, because there's no way I could recreate that now. Yeah. Anne, yep. You have thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there's usually switches of emphasis between generations, but it doesn't mean that everything is going to be lost. The first generation comes speaking a non-English language, and the community is bound by the language for a long time. The kids go to school and learn English. As they learn English, they stop speaking the original language. They become often ashamed of what they're bringing to school for lunch. I've heard people who had Armenian parents and Chinese parents and Latin American parents say the same thing. Why do we have to bring these crazy foods to school where the other kids will laugh at them? Then the next generation very often thinks that the intermediate generation threw out the baby with the bathwater and threw out these valuable traditions, and they become interested in cooking what their grandparents or their great-grandparents did. And they maybe want to go back to the old country. There's just zillions. Well, John would know how many, more than I do, many, many Italian-Americans who have eagerly claimed Italian citizenship and spent long periods of time going back to where their grandparents came from, trying to put down the roots again. So I don't think everything is permanently lost.
Yeah. John, what are your thoughts on we just have about a minute and a half left. What are your thoughts on creating and sustaining meaningful food traditions of your own?
Oh, I do it all the time. My partner and I do it all the time. We have traditions. I did a Valentine's article for the Cape Cod Times on what our tradition was for Valentine's Day. We do it for Christmas. I do there's something called the Zamponi and the Cortegino that it's traditional that you do it around New Year's and you serve it with lentils, and the more lentils you eat, the richer you're going to be for the year. That kind
of thing.
So you
ate a lot of lentils, did you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You eat a lot. But there's, you know, the things that go with it. There's a mostarda, which is a very picante fruit thing that's served with it. But I do. I have a lot of traditions.
And so people should just create their own.
They should. Yeah. And, yeah, they should create their own. I mean, it's fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, food can be fun, exactly. John Carafoli is a food stylist and writer, the author of several cookbooks. His latest is Great Italian-American Food in New England, History, Traditions, and More. Anne Mendelson, culinary historian and author. Her latest book is Chow Chop Suey, Food and the Chinese-American Journey. Thank you both for being here this morning. It's a lot of fun.
Thanks, Mindy.
The pleasure is mine.
Yeah.
Thanks. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.